The Word of Mouth podcast is brought to you by
Dartmouth Hitchcock, creating a new model for healthcare,
where leading health systems collaborate
to improve care for all of us.
A sustainable system improving the health of our communities for years to come.
Information at imagine.d-h.org.
And Northeast Credit Union,
helping their members save money through free checking accounts
and refinancing of auto,
home, and personal loans. Northeast Credit Union,
encouraging you to discover the difference at necu.org.
Federally insured by NCUA.
Equal housing opportunity.
Word of mouth.
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 Mouth.
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. Gluten-free versus gluten-fine. Olive oil or coconut oil for cooking. Mediterranean or paleo. Figuring out a healthy diet is like stepping into the Wild West with shots being fired from every direction. Line up the studies and you'll often find competing results. Wine and coffee, for example, both have been shown to lower and to increase your risk of getting cancer. So if nutrition is a science, why is it so hard to figure out what is good for you and what's bad? Well, the data geeks at 538 have an answer. Christy Ashwanden is 538's lead science writer, and she recently wrote about why nutrition science is so hard to pin down, and in the process discovered some dubious correlations of her own. Christy, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Thanks for having me.
So one of the big problems you outline in your article is pretty basic. It is hard to know what people are eating and how much. So how do researchers usually track food habits?
Sure. The normal way that food habits are tracked in research is with something called a food frequency questionnaire, or FFQ. This is the most common way that people try to figure out what people are eating. And what it is a survey that asks people, there can be different timelines, but a common one would be, over the last 6 months, how often did you eat potato chips, say? And when you ate potato chips, you know, how much did you eat and how often? And so, you know, based on people's answers to things like this, that's how you get correlations. Like in our study, we found that potato chip eating was correlated with a high math score on the SAT.
You tried to keep one of these FFQs of your own. Do you think you kept an accurate count?
It was really difficult. I would say that I don't trust my answers. After taking the FFQ, it sort of spits out an assessment of your diet, what you're eating, how many calories, what sorts of nutrients you're getting, and whatnot. And the FFQ told me that my three top sources of calories were cheese, full fat, both red and white wine, and oatmeal. But things that you eat less often, then the accuracy is going to really go down. You know, I know that most mornings I have a bowl of oatmeal, and so I'm pretty sure about that. But when you ask me about something like cantaloupe or lemonade or bananas, things that I eat sometimes but not a lot, you know, I found myself often as I was taking the test thinking, well, I don't really know, and really feeling like I was guessing.
Well, I guess what one of the things I got from your article was that coming up with portion size or measurements is really a tricky business.
It really is. And I think, you know, I've talked in the past with researchers who study obesity and are trying to help people lose weight. And one of the problems is it's really hard for people to measure serving sizes. You know, it's easy if you're at home and maybe you're using a scale or you're eating something that comes in sort of a discrete packet or something like that. But otherwise, it can be really difficult. One of the questions on the food frequency questionnaire that we took asked, how often do you eat cheese? And, you know, how many slices do you eat? And a lot of the cheese that it turned out that we were eating doesn't really come in slices.
Right.
Or does, you know, we think of it more in chunks. And, you know, how big is a slice? I don't know.
I can understand that. But using this food frequency questionnaire, you did some experimenting to see how easy it is to find these links between individual foods and some possible health factors, like you mentioned potato chips and being good at math. What are some of the other correlations you found, and how do you come up with them?
Yeah, so what we did is we recruited some readers to take the FFQ as well. The FFQ, after someone takes it, spits out this enormous set of data, different variables that you can then look at. And so we paired that with a little quiz that my colleague Walt Hickey sort of came up with. And we asked them about all sorts of things, what religion they were, whether they had a dog or a cat, if they'd had a weird rash in the last year, whether the film Crash deserved to win Best Picture. So some sort of silly things. And so the food frequency questionnaire itself produced over 1,000 variables. that we could then test against the 26 different characteristics, like, you know, what you thought of the movie Crash, that we could compare them against. And so what it did was almost ensured that we would come up with some spurious correlations. And in fact, in our calculations, we found that we should expect at least 1,300 false positives. So it was extremely easy to find things that weren't real.
So just out of curiosity, what were the correlations with the movie Crash?
People who drank lemonade believed that Crash deserved to win Best Picture, but iced tea lovers didn't like Crash.
Also see correlations between eating raw tomatoes and Judaism.
I think my favorite one is that people who trim the fat from their steaks were more likely to be atheists than the people that, you know, ate the fat that God had provided for them.
And this is from the 538 blog. I mean, isn't this all about what data can reveal about us? The aggregator that accurately predicted the 2008 presidential election. How on earth did you come up with these?
Yeah, we just sort of use the same sort of techniques that are used in these nutrition studies. So what they do is, let's say you're interested in cancer and you want to know, are there foods that might be correlated with cancer? Recently, earlier last year, there were some studies that came out looking at meat consumption and cancer, for instance. And so they give a bunch of people the food frequency questionnaires and then sort of sort them into how much meat they're eating and how often, et cetera. And then they look at, you know, who gets cancer and is cancer more common in the people that are eating more meat versus the ones that are eating less. And so this is really sort of the technique that's used. And the problem is that, you know, first of all, correlation is not causation. So very frequently when these studies are reported in the media, you'll see a headline like foods that fight cancer or, you know, something like that that's implying causation. Mm-hmm. These studies just cannot prove causation. They can only suggest.
So eating table salt does not really connect that strongly with the positive relationship with an internet service provider, as you found.
Probably not. And I mean, if you think about it for a second, you know, let's say it's completely possible that correlation is real. That's another important thing to understand, that it may be that these things are correlated, but it doesn't mean that they're causal. So if you don't like your internet or cable provider, you know, putting more salt on your food probably isn't going to help, you know, but it may be that people who eat more salt, you know, tend to watch more TV and the salt's coming from, you know, salty snacks that they're eating while watching television and, you know, et cetera. So there are reasons that something might be correlated, which do not then translate into actionable things that people can do in the way that it's so often presented.
Well, Christy, do you think we're so desperate to know what kind of effect food has on our bodies that on some level we may know these studies offer a simplistic picture, but maybe choose to believe them anyway?
Yeah, I think that's right. I mean, I think most reasonable people understand that, you know, eating more of a particular fruit isn't going to allow them to live forever, right? Right. You know, if eating some particular food really could have your chance of getting cancer, we would all be doing it and it would be a huge public health good. But one of the problems is when they present these results, they're so often presented as relative risks instead of absolute risks. And so that really seems to inflate the effects. But I think fundamentally what we're seeing here is that, you know, scary things happen to people. You get sick, people that were previously healthy develop cancer. And, you know, when these sorts of things happen, the first impulse that we have is to look for a way to protect ourselves or a reason why that's not going to happen to us. And food is one thing that we can actually control as opposed to all these other factors. So I think it's just a natural human reaction to want to control this one thing. And it's sort of a way of trying to get a sense of agency over, you know, impending death, which we can't stop, right?
Right. Christy Ashwinden is lead science writer at 538. You can find a link to read her fantastic article, You Can't Trust What You Read About Nutrition. There's a link at wordofmouthradio.org. The analog revolution is going strong in the digital age. We all know a few vinyl junkies who insist records just sound better than CDs and MP3s. Film nerds exist in a similar old-school universe. Take director Quentin Tarantino. His new movie, The Hateful Eight, was rolled out in a limited number of theaters capable of screening a film shot in 70mm film. Maybe you're not concerned about whether a movie was filmed in film or digital, But have you ever watched a high-def television and thought the picture looked just a little too crisp or detailed or even cheap? Well, with award season underway, Charles Bromesco wrote for Vox about the film versus digital debate and is with us to explain why it's so contentious among filmmakers and fans. Charles, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Hi, thanks for having me on.
So can you break this down for us, for those of us who aren't film nerds, the difference between digital and film?
The core debate between film and digital is that some movies are shot on a celluloid film strip using an older camera. This was the original technology that they used in Hollywood all up until the advent of digital videotape in the 80s and 90s. And so that presented a low-cost alternative to shooting on film, although you sacrifice, when you're using videotape, a sort of aesthetic quality in that the look of digital videotape doesn't have the sort of rich, lived-in quality as a film strip. So your analogy to vinyl versus listening to an MP3 is pretty apt when it comes to the difference between seeing a movie on what they call 35mm film, that refers to the width of the film strip that is run through the projector, or digital video.
There is something that I have noticed, you know, when looking at new, very expensive, high-def televisions, things do look slightly off. Is that an effect of digital? I mean, what's going on there?
The phenomenon you're noticing is something called motion smoothing. It's also colloquially known as soap opera effect or the telenovela effect, because you get that sort of a little weirdly unnatural look where it almost it seems as if things are too sharp in definition. And so a lot of new televisions that you purchase, when they come out of the box, the factory settings have that motion smoothing turned on. And what that does pretty much is it's sort of smooths over the gaps between the images. You know, they run at 24 images every second, and that is how they create the illusion of movement. And so it sort of bridges the gaps between those images. And so in the strictest definition, it is a superior image, and it's a superior experience because you're getting more visual information from the screen. But at the same time, it feels wrong. You know, it's not what we're used to as viewers. And even if it might be technically more sophisticated, it sort of jolts you out of the experience. It doesn't feel like you're watching TV. It feels like you're watching something else.
And plus, we don't want celebrities to have pores.
Of course, yeah. You don't want to be seeing what's going on someone's nose when you look at the TV.
Well, so you said the factory settings. Is that something that we can actually adjust?
Oh, yeah, sure. I mean, just like a little tinkering around on the menu button on your remote, you can track down something. In motion smoothing, some companies will call it a different version of that same term. But it's not too hard to turn off. You can just click it right off.
Well, that is in the digital world of the small screen. But in the big screen, Quentin Tarantino made a big, huge deal about shooting his new film, The Hateful Eight, in 70mm format. So why was that so difficult for a lot of theaters to take?
Well, the standard format that most movies that come to theaters is on 35mm film, which that just describes the width of the film strip. And so 70mm, which is what this big hullabaloo is being made over, it's just it's a wider film strip, but that brings a lot more to the table. As you get more brilliant colors and you get sharper definition when it's projected onto the screen, you get richer sound, and so altogether it's a more immersive experience. But then at the same time, in order to do this, you need very special, what's become hard to find equipment. And so the Weinstein Company, which is the production house that's thrown its weight behind The Hateful Eight, they've gone around trying to snatch up every errant 70mm projector they can to stage this really big undertaking. You know, it involves a lot of very elaborate coordination in trying to collect all this equipment and get projectionists who know how to work it.
Well, okay, so Quentin Tarantino, he's definitely a film nerd. Paul Thomas Anderson,
yeah,
certainly as well. But for you, is there a discernible difference in seeing a film in digital versus 70mm?
I'd say to the average viewer, yes, in fact. I don't think that unless, you know, you've spent a lifetime, you know, devoting your passions to the film form, you might not notice the difference between digital videotape and 35mm. However, the difference between digital videotape and 70mm is immediate, and it's recognizable, and it sort of blows you away. You know, you sit down, and the score gets under your skin. You know, you see the colors, and they stay with you. It's a much more cinematic experience, I guess I would say.
Well, so that is in the theater. But the Canadian director, Xavier Dolan, he wrote to Netflix in the UK, I think, because they started streaming his film, Mommy, in the wrong format, as far as he was concerned. Is that something that would that affect the average viewer's experience?
Very much so, actually. Yes. What he was all heated up about was a dimension of film exhibition called aspect ratio, which just really refers to the shape that a film takes. You know, all films are rectangles, but you might not realize that they are occasionally different shaped rectangles, which may seem like a persnickety thing to get hung up on. But in the instance of a film such as Mommy, which works in these different sort of aspect ratios, turning from a, you know, almost perfectly square image, sort of like an Instagram photo, to in one pivotal moment of the film, it expands to a much wider image. And so in the instance that he was heated up at Netflix because they were cutting off part of his image, you were missing, you know, crucial information in the frame. It's like if you were watching the movie through a little hole in your fingers, you know, it's you're not getting the full experience.
He did triumph, by the way, and there are films like Wes Anderson's The Grand Budapest Hotel that played around with these aspect ratios. So what does that actually look like on a screen?
Well, on the movie screen, when you go out to the movies, one would hope that the projectionists have enough know-how to be able to project it in the correct sort of ratio. But what's really tricky is in home exhibition. You know, when you buy a DVD or a Blu-ray and you bring it home, you either have the option for widescreen or for full screen. And widescreen, you know, you played it, has the black bars at the top and bottom of your television, which some people are perturbed by because it feels as if, you know, you buy this big TV and you're not even using all of it. But what matters is that you're getting the entire image. When you use full screen, even though it does take up the whole of your television, you're missing, you know, columns of the frame on the left and right sides because they have to squeeze it larger to fit it all on the frame. These aspect ratios are important because when you buy a DVD that's not on widescreen, you are essentially missing part of the movie, you know. Important action may not be taking place on the left or right-hand margins of the frame, but it's still part of the composition. You wouldn't look at the Mona Lisa and cut off her ears.
Well, Charles, thank you for speaking with us.
Okay, well, thank you for having me on.
Charles Bromesco, he's a film critic based in Washington, D.C., and a contributor to the pop culture site UpRocks, among other places. We found his article, Film versus Digital, the Most Contentious Debate in the World Explained, on Vox. And you'll find a link to read it yourself at wordofmouthradio.org. For decades, Brooklyn's Coney Island was known for sideshows featuring tattooed ladies, sword swallowers, and Dr. Martin Cooney's incubator babies. Dr. Cooney pioneered the use of incubators to keep premature infants alive in the late 1800s, but the medical establishment initially rejected the practice. So each summer, for 40 years, he funded his work by exhibiting the babies to the public for an admission fee. 95-year-old Lucille Horn was one of those babies. She told her daughter Barbara about spending the summer of 1920 in an incubator on Coney Island for StoryCorps.
My father said I was so tiny he could hold me in his hand. I think I was only about 2 pounds, and I couldn't live on my own. I was too weak to survive.
So the hospital didn't have anything to
offer? No, they didn't have any hope for me at all. It was just, you die because you didn't belong in the world. So when I was born, my father was looking for a blanket or a towel to wrap me up. And then somebody said, where are you going? He said, I'm taking you to the incubator in Coney Island. The doctor said, there's not a chance in hell that she'll live. He said, but she's alive now. He held a taxi cab and took me to Dr. Cooney's exhibit. And that's where I stayed for about 6 months.
Do you know how your parents knew about the incubators?
They saw the exhibit and the honeymoon. You had to pay to go in, and then the babies would be all lined up.
How do you feel knowing that people paid to see you?
It's strange, but as long as they saw me and I was alive, it was all right. I think it was definitely more of a freak show, something that they ordinarily did not see. But I remember going when I was older to see the babies.
You met Dr. Cooney, right?
Yes, he happened to be there at the time I went in. And I went over and I introduced myself to him. And there was a man standing in front of one of the incubators looking at his baby. And Dr. Cooney went over to him and he tapped him on the shoulder. And he said, look at this young lady. She's one of our babies. And that's how your baby's going to grow up. I remember he gave me a hug before I left. You know, there weren't many doctors then that would have done anything for me. 94 years later, here I am, all in one piece. And I'm thankful to be here.
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. Even if you don't know the play, everyone knows the line, right?
If music be the food of... If music be the food of...
The audience is anything but passive in Filter's Twelfth Night, a riotous production of Shakespeare's farce, which is on its way to the Hop at Dartmouth tomorrow night. Filter is known for imaginative productions that play to all the senses, with unexpected costumes, sound-rich elements, and in this play, pizza. For all, Filter's work is much more rock and roll, punk even, than the staid transcriptions of classic plays we've all seen. Perfect for a story about the slippery nature of identity and gender and self-regard. Ferdy Roberts is an actor and artistic director of Filter, which collaborated with the Royal Shakespeare Company on this production of Twelfth Night. And Ferdy Roberts, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Thank you very much. Glad to be here.
I noticed one British newspaper called this the distilled essence of Twelfth Night. Is that accurate?
Yes, I think it probably is accurate. I mean, I'll give a bit of background about how we made the show. We were approached by the Royal Shakespeare Company to respond to Shakespeare's Twelfth Night, and we rather boldly, or some might say stupidly, decided to try and do a version of it in a week, rehearse it from scratch in a week. Yeah. Doing it in a week meant that we had to make very bold decisions in terms of cutting the play and the way that we were going to be able to tell this story with just six actors, two musicians, a drum kit, a keyboard, you know, samplers and what have you. And so what it did was meant it gave us the opportunity to be brave, bold and slightly crazy. Another British paper likened it to what going to a gig rather than a theatre
piece.
Yeah,
I noticed that.
It relies heavily, our version of it relies heavily on the audience. Not in terms of necessarily audience participation. That's something that frightens me completely, sitting in an audience and going, oh no, please don't choose me. But we play a lot with the audience. The audience's energy is important to the piece.
Let me jump in at this point, because there's no fourth wall here. You know, the musicians, the people making the sound effects, all of these traditionally hidden theatrical elements are actually on stage. Now, here's a bit. It's right from the beginning of the play when Viola figures out, she hears from the transistor radio the BBC shipping news that she's been shipwrecked in Illyria. This is how she knows where she is, and she'd fare better as a man. So she asked to borrow a man's jacket from the audience. Let's hear a bit.
Conceal me what I am, and be my aid for such disguise as haply shall become the form of my intent. Have any of you got a man's jacket I could borrow, please? Anyone got a gentleman's? You have. Thank you, sir.
So she asks for a jacket from the audience, and somebody gives it to her. And we should add that she completes her female-to-male transition with a strategically placed, rolled-up wad of socks. So actually, you know, I've been to those plays where people are so anxious about sitting there because they're afraid they might be singled out or picked out of the audience. But somebody does offer her a jacket here. What does that bring, that kind of interaction with the audience, to a production like this?
I think it makes it immediate. I think it makes it, you know, it's very live. It's we're not pretending we're anywhere else other than this theatre here tonight. And the other thing that it does is it also allows, we hope and we think, it allows an audience to be more comfortable and settled, knowing that they are as much a part of this story as anybody, as the actors. Does that make sense?
It does. I mean, also, I think it's unexpected. So it does make things really funny. And this is, of course, you know, it's one of Shakespeare's comedies. But is it a challenge, you know, 400 years plus later to make something that is so familiar on one level, but so out of date, funny?
Yeah, I suppose it is a challenge. I mean, we were always, I have to say, when I was at college, my education put me slightly in fear of it, of Shakespeare's plays and his writing and his words, because I always, you know, you're always told that Shakespeare's for the intelligentsia. It's mm-hmm. it's an academic piece, and that, you know, to understand Shakespeare, you have to understand the iambic pentameter. You have to understand you have to understand the language, and it's really difficult language if it's sort of approached like that, I find. And what we always wanted to do was to take away those barriers, and unshackle the language and unshackle an audience from feeling afraid of it. Mm-hmm. And it is something for everybody. And I think our approach to it, I hope, I mean, we've performed this play across the world over the past 10 years. The show has just returned from India before coming out here. And the actors had some extraordinary experiences, humbling experiences.
But like
playing
what?
Playing it to 7,500 underprivileged children in one show, in one gig, you know, was one of the highlights for them.
Wow.
And playing to an audience where English isn't the first language, what they understood and what they got and what was the essence of the play. They understood the lightness. They understood how Shakespeare talks about life and death in a breath, you know. They managed to understand the energy of the piece without having to understand all the language. I performed it in Mexico a few years ago at a festival. And at the end of the show, a lady came up with her grandson. And this little boy was probably 5, maybe.
Mm-hmm.
And his grandmother was in tears. And there was a translator there who basically relayed to me what this lady was saying. She'd spent her whole life wanting to go to the theatre, but she'd never been able to afford it. And because this festival was free, she was able to come along, and she brought her grandson. And this lady was in tears, and she must have been, I think, probably in her 70s. And she just said to me, he will remember this moment for the rest of his life. You know, I think as a piece, it does transcend the language barrier, if you like.
Filter and the Royal Shakespeare Company's production of Twelfth Night has been called Rock and Roll Shakespeare and a blast. And it's headed to the Hop at Dartmouth on Friday night. I'm talking with Ferdy Roberts. He's artistic director of Filter, also an actor. And Ferdy, I saw only a video production of the play, but the actors were sweating and strained. It looks like a very strenuous physical performance, you know? Malvolio is at one point stripped down to these bright yellow shorts and, I don't know, leg warmers, glistening with sweat. You know, obviously you're
That's part of the reason why I can't do it anymore.
So you used to play Malvolio.
Yeah. I did, yeah.
But this, you know, you're in it in such a deep way, and I'm wondering, you know, as an actor on that stage, you know, in this tremendously physical, you're in it kind of performance, you know, seeing how you're affecting other people, what does that do to you? How does that change how you conduct yourself on stage?
That's a really tough question. It is overwhelming in a way when you realise you have an audience that are sitting on the edge of their seats because you're talking directly to them. That moment where Malvolio realises his dream of being loved has always shocked me wherever we've played this, because, you know, we've had people walk out at that moment in disgust. We've had school children going wild, and it to me it feels like what it must feel like to be, I don't know, Mick Jagger or some great lead front man or woman, you know. This show, Twelfth Night, has changed my thinking about what acting is, my relationship to being an actor, realising that actually, do you know what, I think a lot of theatre, we've lost our way because we forget about the audience, we forget that we're sharing a story, and that theatre actually is a form of entertainment. It's changed my thinking, if that makes any sense. Mm-hmm.
I was reading a review in The Telegraph, and Charles Spencer begins with a health warning for readers who hate productions that, quote, mess around with Shakespeare. And he says, this one He writes, could reduce the bard's more puritanical followers to a state of terminal apoplexy. So, So do you even try to win the purists over anymore?
No, not really. I don't think we ever intended to anyway. I mean, I've always thought that good art, good theatre, good music it divides opinion, you know. And that performance, the press night performance in London when Charles Spencer was there and Michael Billington and what we call the sort of old school critics mm-hmm. were there. We were terrified because we were sort of going, oh God, what are they going to think? Oh no, you know. But I remember looking out at the audience when the pizzas are delivered.
Yeah, clarify that for our audience, if you would.
There's a moment in the play where Toby Belch is trying desperately to creep in to the household very quietly, but everything he does is amplified. You know that moment, maybe not anymore these days, but when you were younger, possibly, creeping in quite late at night, maybe having had a drink or two, you know. It's that essence. That's the essence of what Belch is doing. And from that moment, he sort of starts to sing a song very quietly to himself about what love is, what it means to him. And very slowly and painstakingly, it turns into a riotous house party where the audience become party. They get involved. The audience are invited to come and get involved in it.
So it's a party and they call for pizza.
The idea is that, and I threw this in actually the press night. None of the actors knew we were going to do it. I went next door to the theatre in London, and I didn't tell anybody that I was going to do this. But I ordered 15 pizzas from the pizza place next door, and nobody on stage knew what was going to happen. And during the party, the pizza delivery man actually came into the theatre and came up on stage. Again, it was sort of a revelatory moment because the audience were involved, the audience were partying, the audience were enjoying themselves. Mm. They were throwing the balls around, they were eating pizza. And I'll never forget looking out and seeing Michael Billington, who writes for The Guardian. I'll never forget seeing him put his notepad down with a slice of pizza in his hand, throwing a ball. And I suddenly went, great, you know, maybe, just maybe, we might have a success here. Who knows?
Well, Ferdie Roberts, I want to thank you so much for speaking
Pleasure.
With us.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Ferdie Roberts is an actor and artistic director of Filter, which in association with the Royal Shakespeare Company presents Twelfth Night, that's at the Hop, the Hopkins Center for the Arts at Dartmouth, on Friday, January 15th. And it's going to be followed by a Q&A with the cast and producers. And who knows, you may even get pizza. More information at wordofmouthradio.org. Off the coast of Virginia, in the middle of the Chesapeake Bay, lies a shrinking island called Tangier. Here, an unlikely adventurer docked his sailboat and encountered what may be the last people to speak in the original Shakespearean accent, although not in iambic pentameter. Lilia Fukin has the story.
In 2011, a blue-eyed Vietnam veteran set sail in the tiny, beat-up boat he called home. The man, Hamilton Meadows. The destination, Tangier Island. The boat's name, The Tempest.
Bella, red light's blinking?
Yeah, right. You're on.
Today is April 23rd. This is Shakespeare's birthday. I'm Hamilton Meadows. I'm going to be taking this ship, The Tempest, over to Tangier Island to record the people that live there who still speak in a version of the old Shakespearean English.
Hamilton's project caught the attention of Daniel Fromson, a writer who found it compelling, if a little nutty.
I think even Hamilton would tell you that it was a pretty crazy idea.
You see, for generations, a few core families have lived on this remote island, and they're a pretty tight-knit community.
Historically, they haven't always gotten along well with outsiders. And somebody who says he's from New York City shows up and says, oh, would you read some Romeo and Juliet for me?
The response was mixed. But here's one young Tangierman who is eager to explain his dialect.
You see a girl out, and you say, darn if she's no good. You know, you're saying she's hot.
It's this accent that's been rumored to have stayed the same since it arrived on Virginia's shores hundreds of years ago. Hamilton thought this could be as close as he could get to the accent Shakespeare would have used. And this is what he heard.
Two households, both alike in dignity, in fair Verona,
where we lay our sin.
So suspected as the time and place doth make against me of this direful murder.
The problem was, how would Hamilton know if this is really what Elizabethan actors sounded like 400 years ago?
The main person who has explored this is an independent linguist formerly affiliated with a variety of universities in Britain named David Crystal.
And Crystal's verdict?
The Tangier Island accent is indeed very conservative compared with almost any other American accent that I know. But when you compare it with OP, the Shakespearean original pronunciation, there are lots of differences. And it's quite clear that in the 400 years, the accents have changed in Tangier just as they have everywhere else.
Crystal brings original pronunciation to life. Here, he recites the opening lines of Henry V.
Oh, for a muse of fire that would ascend the brightest heaven of invention. But in OP it would be, oh, for a muse of fire that would ascend the brightest heaven of invention. The two main things about OP when you hear it is, first of all, the rhymes work, which don't work in modern English, and secondly, you get puns and wordplay.
10 years ago, after the first OP production at Shakespeare's Globe in London, Crystal asked the audience what they thought of the accent.
And the answer was always, oh, we speak like that where I come from. Regardless of where they came from, you know, whether it was Ireland or Scotland or the West Country or Virginia, people heard echoes of their own accent in this OP.
How can a dead accent sound so familiar?
The accent that was in English round about the year 1600 is, of course, the great granddaddy of all these modern accents. You know, it travelled across in the Mayflower, for example, and inevitably, some Americans will hear some familiarity in it.
Back in New York City, our sailor, Hamilton Meadows, did produce an off-Broadway OP production of Twelfth Night. And the fact that Tangier Island is not the last bastion of Elizabethan English hasn't quashed his hopes of having a Shakespeare festival on its slowly disappearing shores. You can find Daniel Fromson's story about Hamilton Meadows at atavist.com. For the Virginia Foundation for the Humanities, I'm Lilia Fukin.
Well, if you're a fan of the show, you know you can always catch it here on NHPR online or by downloading the Word of Mouth podcast. Well, if that's not enough for you, we have another podcast called the 10-Minute Writer's Workshop. That's where we go behind the scenes with renowned authors to find out what really goes into their work. Today, Stacey Schiff, the Pulitzer Prize-winning author of the biography Cleopatra and the Witches, a rich history of the 1692 Salem witch trials. We spoke to her in the green room of the Music Hall in Portsmouth just moments before she headed into the spotlight for Writers on a New England Stage.
So what do you think is harder to write, the first sentence or the last sentence?
And just definitely the first sentence. First sentence goes through many drafts. Yeah, the last sentence writes itself.
War.
You always know where you're going to end.
So are there any habits that you as a writer would encourage others to take up to avoid or in order to be more productive?
I would say avoid your email, which is probably my single greatest sin in my workday. I can't write a sentence without checking my email 6 times. I don't think that's a particularly effective habit.
So this is an aspiration for you?
The aspiration would be work in a room where there's no internet access.
So do you limit that to, you say to yourself, 1 hour, two hours?
I write a little note to myself saying, check your email at 10:10, and at 9:03 I'm checking my email. Yes.
Do you edit as you go, or do you wait till the end?
I edit as I go, because I don't know where I'm going to go until I have something solid. I feel like the ground has to be solid before I can take the next step.
But then do you spend a lot of time doing a rewrite, edit?
As I go, I spend a lot of time reworking.
Oh, so yeah. It's not the full lump. Which is interesting, because you used to be an editor, so you used to get full books, I'm guessing?
The problem with having been an editor is it's like having been a surgeon. You can't operate on yourself. I can't edit myself. So I know exactly what's going to go wrong, but I can't avoid falling into those pitfalls myself. It's very frustrating.
What's your personal worst distraction? Email?
Email, email, email. Or food. Email or food. Food, sugar, or email. I'd say it's those two things, yeah.
So deep padlock your refrigerator.
I just eat a lot of junk.
What do you think is the most common mistake that new writers make?
That's a good question. I guess probably writing something that you think someone else wants to read as opposed to reading what you actually want to write. In other words, trying to please the outside critic as opposed to your as to opposed to writing what's honest to you.
So what was that process like for you? Kind of, did you have to exercise that that critic?
You know, my first book was a biography, which is, in a funny way, it's easier when you write biography because there's a built-in beginning, middle, and end. Mm-hmm. And there's a certain discipline already there, and there are confines which you have to respect. And by the time I had written a book that was a little more creative, I was a more experienced writer.
What do you think was your best training for being a biographer?
Reading, reading, and reading, probably. Huh. I mean, I can't think of any other way to become a writer than just by imbibing vast amounts of print.
I'm curious about the role of a biographer, you know, diving into other people's lives.
Well, it's like high-class gossip, basically. I mean, I think it helps to have a certain amount of compassion or interest in other people. I'm inherently not interested in myself, which I think is probably a biographer's, you know, to the biographer's credit, or at least a good tool for the biographer. Other people seem much more interesting than I do, so that's a help.
Are there any books that you would recommend that people read as tools to learn about writing?
I would say a book that I have never been able to take to heart, which is Bill Zinsser on Writing Well, which is this lovely, really elegant, concise book about writing short Anglo-Saxon sentences and not using commas and semicolons and hyphens, which I abuse constantly.
What's the best piece of advice on writing that you ever got?
Write so that the reader will want to turn the page. Or the old stage adage, keep your hero in trouble. Because that's, of course, what you're all reading for, right? Keep, you know, make sure there's menace and peril on the horizon, and then there's actually inherent drama.
I noticed that you thanked several research assistants in this book and in others. So what makes a good research assistant?
The research assistant of one's dreams is the tenacious one. It's the one where you say, you know, could you get me this article, please? And the researcher delivers not just that article, but the two articles that also slightly resemble it, which you hadn't thought to ask for. Because most of the time you'll throw them away, but every once in a while it's something that, had you known of its existence, you would have asked for it too.
How about an editor? What do you look for in an editor?
Somebody who wants to publish me.
How many times were you rejected before being published?
Interestingly, not, but I've certainly been rejected since. And don't think I've let those people forget it either.
How about your habits of writing? Pen, pencil, computer
pencil,
typewriter?
Pencil, mechanical pencil. Oh. Mechanical pencil with an eraser on it, highly crucial, on a legal yellow legal pad.
Any rules that you follow about grammar, structure, content that go through your head when you're writing?
No, I think it's a sort of, not mystical process, but organic process, so I'm really not thinking. The rhythm is very, it's a musical thing in a funny way. You're composing to the rhythm. And you're trying to be as concise as possible, which is one reason I write by hand, because I find that I'm a very fast typist, and if I write on the computer, I'm much wordier than I needed to be.
Fantasy job other than writer? Do you have one?
I want to be a rockette.
Good luck with that, Stacey.
Thank you.
And thank you.
I don't think that's in the cards.
That was Stacey Schiff, the Pulitzer Prize-winning author of Cleopatra and the Witches, Salem 1692, speaking with me backstage at the Music Hall in Portsmouth. Well, if you're a writer or a creative person who just likes to dilly-dally or just likes hearing about them, you can hear several more authors in our 10-Minute Writers Workshop, including Alexander McCall Smith, Patti Smith, and Salman Rushdie. And we're adding new writers all the time. You can find it on our website, wordofmouthradio.org, or by searching 10-Minute Writers Workshop on iTunes. And if you do listen to the podcast, please take a moment and rate it. It really does help other people find worthwhile podcasts in this huge sea of material that's out there right now. So please take a moment and weigh in. Thank you so much for your listening time today. There is, as always, much more to hear and explore at wordofmouthradio.org. And this is Word of Mouth from NHPR.